Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
So what's the future of the Republican Party?
The Republican Party?
Is this the right show? Yes, it is. What's the future of the Republican Party? What's going on with these folks? And some of their, helpers. The Club for Growth, for example, that ran $1 million worth of advertising against Howard Dean in Iowa in the 2004 primaries. Good question. Steve Laffey is here. He has a new book out called Primary Mistakes, how the Republican establishment lost everything in 2006 and sabotaged my senatorial campaign. He's with the Club for Growth, the website clubforgrowth.org/slaffey.php. And Steve Laffey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on. I am actually not with the Club for Growth. I don't work for them or anything like that. I just happen to have been funded by them in the last Senate race I had.
Ah, okay. Thank you
for
that.
Yeah, I don't work for them. Don't have anything to do with them officially, just that they help fund my campaign.
So you don't know why they ran that ad against Howard Dean?
No idea. I don't know why they run ads against or for anybody else.
Yeah,
I'd imagine if he's not for school choice, doesn't want lower taxes, doesn't want to cut government waste, and doesn't like free trade, they would run an ad against him.
Yeah, well, which brings us to the issue of your book. You were the guy, if my understanding is correct, from looking this thing over, you're the guy who was taking on Lincoln Chafee.
Yes, I had been an investment banker, graduate of Harvard Business School, ran a big investment banking firm, came home to my city of Cranston, Rhode Island, where I grew up. The city went broke, went to the lowest bond rating in America. I stopped my career, fixed the city of Cranston, won re-election with 65% of the vote in a city where Democrats outnumber Republicans by 3-1. And then, yes, ran for the U.S. Senate and did not win in the primary against Lincoln Chafee.
Right. And now Lincoln Chafee has left the party, as I recall.
Yeah. Then Lincoln Chafee, as I said then and I said now, he was always going to leave the party, win, lose, or draw. And I never thought he was going to win because in Rhode Island or maybe anywhere else, maybe in Oregon, if you get a choice between a real Democrat and a faux Democrat, you end up choosing the real thing.
Well, which is a rephrase of Harry Truman's old comment about how if voters are given a choice between a real Republican or a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, they'll choose the Republican every time, which I think is the big danger for the so-called centrists and moderates, and for that matter, the weak-kneed bunch in the Democratic Party right now. You're saying the same thing in the Republican Party. Here's the question, Steve Laffey, as a Republican, as a former politician, as somebody who's run for political office, starting with Ronald Reagan, when the policies that you ticked off so quickly when we first started this segment a few minutes ago, since Ronald Reagan came into office, Republicans have run up a larger debt. They have borrowed more money than all other presidents in the history of this country. We have seen wages, real wages of working people since Reagan came into office, steadily decline. Whereas for the 40 years prior to that, during the New Deal era, they had been steadily and significantly increasing. We saw if you convert tax incomes into inflation-adjusted dollars, and you go from 1960, there's several good posts of this all around the internet. There's one over at Daily Kos, and you go from 1960 to today, you see two dips in real dollar tax incomes after the Reagan tax cuts and after the Bush tax cuts. But essentially, they've been flat. It has more to do with GDP than it does with tax cuts or not tax cuts. The outcome of the policies of 26 years of basically Republican rule, and I throw Bill Clinton to that category as well, 7 million Americans have lost their health. This just since Bush came into power. 7 million Americans lost health insurance. 5 million Americans slipped into poverty. Median income, household income has dropped by $1,300. 3 million manufacturing jobs lost just in the last 6 years. 3 million Americans lost their pensions. How could anybody in America, how could any working person in America anyway, I don't understand why investment bankers might think that the Republican Party is great, but how do you expect to reach out to working people in America when over 26 years the Republicans have basically screwed them?
Well, that was one of the longest questions I've ever been given in my entire lifetime.
Well, it's a rant. I mean, you know, it's not just a question. This is talk radio.
That's okay. My philosophy is, I guess, vastly different. In 1979, when I was 17 years old, we watched Jimmy Carter as president give a in 1980 give a malaise speech. Prime rate was 20%. I could go on all day. basically, the philosophy of Ronald Reagan, which was limited government and strong national defense, worked very well. Since 1980, people live in bigger homes. 100 million or plus people in Eastern Europe now live free through the work of, by the way, many people, Democrats and Republicans. Both have good people. Both have bad people. But the prospects for growth of this world and for people coming out of poverty has been huge. And people live much better than they did today around the world since 1980 to today. It's in 2007, in 27 years. Real incomes are up. But listen, my book is about, just to get back to the book I wrote, Primary Mistake, it's about how George Bush and the heads of the Republican Party, including Karl Rove, put power over principle to such an nth degree that they ended up losing both. I mean, Karl Rove was probably a pretty good guy to get you elected. He's a lousy guy, and I've said this for a long time, not just since he's left working for George Bush. He's a lousy guy to put policies in place for the long-term benefit of the American people or for the Republican Party. Just a bad guy to have around.
Yeah,
what's
that?
So I am a populist outsider reformer who comes in and fixes it. I'll just give you an example. I was mayor of Cranston, Rhode Island. It wasn't a Republican or Democrat thing. I come from a toolmaker and household. I come from a working-class family. I know what it's like for my father to lose a manufacturing job because I watched him do it. I watched my mother and father make, sandwiches made out of ketchup and mayonnaise.
So then why would you support these free trade agreements that
free trade
no longer...
General, free trade in general lifts all boats, yes.
No, it hasn't,
just,
though.
Are they just... Listen, we can go back to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, Tom. They didn't work out too well.
The Smoot-Hawley tariffs was just a bump in the road. The tariffs started in this country in 1787.
To a Great Depression. So I'm not for that. I'm actually for free trade.
Steve, I'm for,
for example.
Listen, Steve, I'm not going to filibuster you, let's try not to talk over each other, okay? If you don't mind, we can bounce back and forth. Interrupt me, I'll stop, and vice versa. Smoot-Hawley, first of all, was something that Herbert Hoover put into place in order to try to mitigate the Great Depression. It was it was 1930 when Smoot-Hawley was put into place. And so it didn't cause the Great Depression. The crash of 29 had already happened.
The Great Depression was actually caused mostly by a contraction of the money supply of about 25%, as cited in Milton Friedman's great
right.
work.
By the Fed. And I'll agree with you on that.
Yes.
But in large part, I would say. But the tariffs in this country, 100% of the income of the federal government from the founding of this country until the Civil War, 100% was on tariffs. Two-thirds, 66% of the income of the federal government from the end of the Civil War until World War I was from tariffs. One-third of the income for the federal government from the end of World War I to the end of World War II was from tariffs. Those tariffs were used as the original enacting legislation in 1787, before the Constitution was even ratified, that Tench Cox had lobbied for, were there to protect American jobs. We said, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in Connecticut, and you want to make those shoes in China where it's 10 cents worth of labor, or you want to make them in Mexico where it's 20 cents worth of labor, that's fine, we can't stop you. But when you import those shoes from China, there's going to be a 90 cent import tariff, and when you import them from Mexico, there's going to be an 80 cent import tariff, so the cost of labor is equalized. That went away under Reagan, Bush, and Clinton, those three presidents, under this policy of neoliberalism that came into effect in the United States in 1981, that is referred to as free trade. And my dad worked in a tool and die shop too. And I can tell you, we saw that happen. First it was actually the Italian tool and die makers who were competing, and then it was the Taiwanese, and now it's the Chinese. And I just don't get it how you can say that wasn't a good policy when it built your family and it built mine, and it's not around building anybody else's now.
Well, the change in jobs out of both farming and out of this, by the way, this is a history show. We can do a history show. But the change of out of farming and out of manufacturing into more high tech jobs, there is certainly every case to be made, as Alan Greenspan makes in the introduction of his book that he wrote just recently, that there are dislocations and no one should take them lightly. But the basic truth about free trade is that it lifts all boats, and it has many countries, and it's doing it today. And it's doing it in Estonia. And it's
So you're suggesting that we in the United States have an obligation to worry about all countries rather than the United States?
No, it is actually better in our own self-interest for the United States of America to engage in free trade.
And we've lost 15 million manufacturing jobs since this began.
We may have lost some manufacturing jobs, but we've gained jobs other places. And
McDonald's,
Boeing, or in high tech. I mean, once again, that's not what my
Boeing is making things in China now.
Tom, it's not what my book is about. My book, Primary Mistake, is actually about how the National Republican Party went away from principle to such a degree, as seen through my eyes in a grassroots crop duster tale, which I hope you'll find interesting if you read
it. Yeah, no, I find it's fascinating, and I'm trying to talk about those principles and see if you can stick around for a second. We'll we can continue this conversation because I would like to get your take on where the Republican Party is going and what happened to you, and get back to your book if you don't mind it, because we've digressed a bit here. We're talking with Steve Laffey, Republican primary candidate against Lincoln Chafee, and former mayor of, where was it? I'm sorry, Steve's on hold already. Steve, we'll be back with Steve Laffey in just a minute. His book, Primary Mistakes, How the Washington Republican Establishment Lost Everything in 2006. Stick around, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. We're talking with Steve Laffey, his book, Primary Mistakes, How the Washington Republican Establishment Lost Everything in 2006. Steve, in your book, you have a chapter called Body Blow Number One. You're talking about how the party hitting and hurting itself. No Democrat left behind. You talk about how the Democrats have owned the issue of education and the Republicans should take it back by privatizing education.
No, I say very explicitly that George Bush ran on an issue of vouchers, which I would agree is a great Republican issue because it promotes competition and choice for parents, especially minorities who are stuck, especially in inner cities in lousy schools and can't seem to get their kids out. They need a check to get them to a better school. George Bush, though, tried to use triangulation, which might have worked with Clinton, but it certainly didn't work when he negotiated with Ted Kennedy. They tried for a short-term gain in the polls on education by starting and funding No Child Left Behind. It turns out that worked for about 6 months, maybe 8 months, and then the Democratic Party was ahead on education.
Well, and they lost both sides on this. I mean, that's why Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's why most Democrats are opposed to it now as well. It didn't work. It was lousy legislation.
It's lousy legislation. The best way to educate children is at the local level and then work your way up to the federal level if at all needed, and certainly having a new federal program, No Child Left Behind, the only thing that's left for, you know, people like Ted Kennedy to say is it doesn't work because it needs more money. It doesn't need more money. It needs to be ended. We need to give, you know, in our education system here in America, we are dying the death of a thousand cuts by not training and educating our children. We would do a much better job if parents would receive a check based upon income, a voucher system, where they could send their kids to the schools that they think are best for them. That would be better.
So you think here's the criticism against voucher systems. Other than there's two main criticisms. One is that what you're going to end up with is ghettoization of public schools. They're going to end up with the toughest kids or the hardest kids or the neighborhoods where people can't add what has to be added to the voucher in order to get into a private school. Your typical private school tuition in the United States right now is around $7,000 or $8,000 a year. I've never seen Republicans propose vouchers over $3,000 a year, which means that a family that can't pull $4,000 out of their pocket is not going to be able to send their kids to even the baseline, you know, private school. Oh. And so it's really a subsidy for the middle class and upper middle class, and you end up with the ghettoization of the school system and gutting of public schools.
In South Providence, Rhode Island today, we have the ghettoization of public schools where letters go out to parents saying all of the schools are failed, so under No Child Left Behind, you have nowhere to go. They try to get over to my city, which is next door, illegally. I can't blame them for trying to do that, to get into a decent school system. So,
but isn't this the result?
Well, that there is a school system, and there's a school in Cranston, Rhode Island, CJCR, which charges $4,500 and educates kids wonderfully well at the elementary school level. It would be a great place to give parents a check who are poor to get them out of these failed school systems so they don't end up in correction institutes when they're adults. Rather, they can get their chance.
So if you want to give the parents $4,500 to go to this private school, why not instead have the public schools be learning the lessons from the private schools and fix them? I mean, our public schools worked really well for a long time in the United States. I would submit to you that, and I've been watching this myself. I actually have done consulting work for both public and private schools for years, and I'm on the board of a private school, that it's been this war against public education over the last 26 years that has in large part led to the destruction of our schools.
No, well, not in Rhode Island. In Rhode Island and around the nation, they've been getting more money every year to educate kids, and it costs
not in real dollars.
$12,000 to $14,000 per average student and over $20,000 per special ed student. In Rhode Island, we have the highest percentage of quote-unquote special ed students. The National Education Association basically runs this joint. They understand that competition would be good for students. They simply don't like it, Tom. So to think that parents don't know what's best for their children, the federal government needs to step in and say this is where they have to be educated. We've tried this for a long time. I was the mayor of a city for 4 years. My kids were in public school here in Cranston, Rhode Island, at the time I was mayor. I have five children and one more on the way. They've all been educated in different...
Steve, we just have about a minute and a half left. Now, I want to get to a few other topics, but your point is made, and you made it very eloquently. Thank you. What do you see as the major mistakes that the Republican Party is making right now?
One, that they're still trying to, for example, reauthorize No Child Left Behind. President Bush, for example, had a unique opportunity after 9/11, the tragic day of 9/11, to both secure our southern borders, which, by the way, would be better for Mexico and be better for Mexican citizens if they were finally forced to face their own problems, and the horrific situation of having, I've been south of the border, watching pregnant women try to walk 4 nights and 3 days across the desert. So it would be much better to just secure our borders, make our nation safer domestically, and also it would have been better, for example, on these issues like No Child Left Behind, to take Republican principles on free trade and about competition. Competition works. We should be for that. Now, I know you're not a Republican, but that's how Republicans ultimately...
Well, if you're going to do free trade, you're going to say there's no borders for corporations. Why should there be borders for people?
Well, there are borders for our country, the United States of America.
Free trade is no borders for corporations.
I reject the last 20 seconds the thought that we are not a sovereign nation. We are.
Yeah, that's what I'm pointing that out as the hole in the logic of free trade.
Yeah, the logic, listen, I taught the top finance course at the State University for 3 years while I was mayor here in Rhode Island. I'm an economics major. Free trade works. It rises all boats and is in our national interest to have free
trade. It works for transnational corporations very well. It doesn't work for working people.
It works very well for working people. Working people have done much better in America since this country started, and since 1980. Look at the average size of an American home. It's up 1,000 to 1,500 feet per home since 1980.
And so is its mortgage. So is its debt. But anyway, so this is what you think the Republican Party should run. It's interesting. People can check it out. It's actually a fascinating read. Primary Mistake, How the Washington Republican Establishment Lost Everything in 2006 and Sabotaged My Senatorial Campaign. Steve Laffey. Thanks, Steve, for being
with us. Thank you so much.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
So let's see. Yesterday, oh, by the way, just a heads up, on October 6th, what is that, a week from this Saturday, I believe, on October 6th, I'll be speaking at the Washington, D.C. Green Festival at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center at 6 p.m. on the main stage, which is actually an hour different than what it says on the program. Just a heads up for those of you who may be planning on heading over there, and look forward to seeing you there. And it's a slim possibility. We may even have advanced copies of my new book, Cracking the Code, which is going to be coming out sometime in October or early November. The official release date is early November. So anyhow, yesterday we had on the program Rich Galen, the senior advisor to the Fred Thompson campaign, talking about how basically we should privatize all parts of our military except shooting people. And Blackwater's a wonderful organization and doing fine work. My recollection is that the Marine Corps has always, I mean, literally since the founding of this country, in fact, in part of the rationale for the creation of the Marine Corps early on was to protect people in embassies, you know, to protect their embassy staff around the United States. But in any case, I guess now that's Blackwater's job. And that, you know, saying that we should privatize basically everything except killing people, which is really going to encourage people to want to join the military and learn skills that you can apply to the civilian field, right? Become all you can be. And today we have Steve Laffey talking about how the Republicans need to be running on school vouchers and free trade for corporations, no borders for corporations, but strong borders for humans. And we didn't have really time to get into all the other issues in his book. He goes through a number of them. The next one after the first body blow, he points out being the lack of school vouchers, that the Republican Party's not just pounding on this thing, is that the Republican Party's not making enough noise about the war on terror and the Islamofascists. I just, respectfully have to say, as an observer from the scene, I am not paid by the Republican or Democratic Party and have, frankly, no affiliation with either. In fact, I'm registered as an independent right now and have been most of my life. That, although I tend to vote generally Democratic, I actually voted for Jim Jeffords for the Senate when I lived in Vermont. The guy was a Republican, so I guess I really am an independent. And although Jim Jeffords then left the Republican Party, God bless Jim Jeffords. But in any case, my point is, I think that if the Republican Party listens to its right-wing base, to its far-right base, to the Club for Growth base, and continues to run on these policies that we've tried. I mean, this is the experiment that Reagan brought to us, and we've tried. And Clinton even went along with a lot of it. That they're going to fail. And I realize that there are guys on Fox News every day saying, well, if the Democrats listen to MoveOn.org and Marcos over at the Daily Kos and cave into that and Hartman on Air America and the Democratic Party is going to go down and flank. Well, the fact of the matter is that when you poll Americans and you ask them, do you want strong public schools? Do you want strong public education? Do you want to go back to a public education system like we had back in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, early 80s in the United States when actually the schools by and large worked by funding our schools? Yes, of course, the funding has gone up since then in pre-inflation adjusted dollars, but in inflation adjusted dollars, no. What we're seeing is our schools are crumbling. Our investments in educational infrastructure has declined dramatically since the late 1930s. And our classroom size is getting larger and teachers are more and more overburdened. There's a whole bunch of variables, obviously, in this. The increasing levels of poverty in the United States, the increasing numbers of working poor in the United States. And again, I'd point back to largely Republican free trade policies, although they've been picked up by the Clinton administration, were run with really hard. But nonetheless, these conservative or neoliberal or whatever you want to call it, corporatist so-called free trade policies as being one of the things that's wiping this out. I find it interesting when Republicans say, well, real incomes in the United States are going up. Well, yeah, if you average in Bill Gates' income along with, somebody working at Walmart, if you average in all the billionaires and millionaires, then, yeah, even in inflation-adjusted dollars, there's been a slight increase in income over the last 20 years. But when you take out the top one-tenth of 1%, those people earning over $3.5 million a year, you take them out, and you're looking at everybody else, what we've seen is a steady decline in wages ever since the early 1980s. Arguably ever since the late 70s with stagflation, which then raises the question, why stagflation? We had a listener yesterday suggesting, well, it was because in 71, 72, Nixon took us off the gold standard, and that led to the explosion of interest rates in the late 70s. It could be, Ravi Batra suggested last week that there's these 30-year cycles that we see in the United States. It's just, hey, that's life. I suspect that there's a whole confluence of events here. Jimmy Carter, in some ways, was even beginning to move in these corporatist directions. But if you poll the majority of Americans, what you find is that the majority of Americans are with us on things like a good, solid national health care system, good, solid public education as a public trust, as the commons, not as a semi-privatized system with vouchers, but as the commons. A good investment in our children. Most Americans are in favor of investing in our infrastructure. Most Americans are in favor of the government even being the employer of last resort, maintaining a lower level of unemployment than we have, if that's what it takes, of strong unemployment programs. I mean, we actually in America take less vacations and work more hours than any other country in the world, and yet we have there's dozens of countries that have higher standards of living. So anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, by the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message board, blogging over at AirAmerica.com on the Tom Hartmann page. PC in Florida. Hey, PC, what's up?
Hillary Clinton, by the powers that be.
Oh, it's Armin. How are you, Armin?
Hey, buddy. They're setting her up. Here's what I predict. I can see this going on, and I bet I'm 100% accurate. They're setting her up so that they can totally destroy the new invigorated grassroots Democratic let's take back our party movement. That's what they're doing. That's why they want her up there. I can't find anybody out here that will admit that they would even consider voting for her. So it's all Rupert Murdoch, Sumner Redstone, the big medias. They've decided to set her up, draw all the people, make them believe that she's for real. And she's really running out front, which she really isn't as far as the people out here in reality. And then they want to destroy her politically because she really is that dirty. I had an argument with Malloy last night, and all she got to do is take Hillary Clinton's name and go to Google and put in scandal. And if you got a month, just read about the stuff. And
yeah, but
stuff,
I get your point, Armin. And the vast majority of those things were funded by Richard Mellon's scaife and whatnot. I mean, you know, the Arkansas Project and everything else. There is a very real question in my mind about how progressive Hillary Clinton is or will be or will govern. And yet, the thing I keep reminding myself is that Franklin Roosevelt did not run for election in 1932 as a progressive. He ran as a middle-of-the-road Democrat, right down the middle. Teddy Roosevelt, who was arguably our most progressive president, ran as vice president with McKinley as the rich white guy who was going to protect corporate interests, not as a progressive. And he was, you know, the trust buster. He was the guy who busted up the big corporations. Franklin Roosevelt brought us the New Deal. Abraham Lincoln did not run on a platform of ending slavery. And yet he ended up doing that. So I have a lot of hope, frankly, that what's happening is that the base is getting invigorated, that people are waking up. And as I said, if you ask the vast majority of Americans what they want, you find that they are right there with MoveOn.org, The Daily Kos, Common Dreams, Buzz Flash, Op-Ed News, this program. The majority, frankly, of what I think we can frankly and candidly call mainstream American mainstream programming, mainstream positions. And the far left, the Communist Party of the United States, who thinks that all businesses in the United States should be owned by the government, they're marginalized. And the problem is that the far right, which believes that there should be no role for government, has had too much power too long, and they're just destroying this country. They're setting us up for another Republican Great Depression, in my opinion. Rob in Long Island. Hey, Rob, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I was thinking about this, and I tried to get through to you guys yesterday, but the line was busy, and this guy that you were talking to at the top of the hour kind of brought it back to me. Everybody's talking about this whole thing with wages declining and jobs being shipped overseas and how much better it is for the country. But the fact of the matter is, you've got this strike that GM's going through right now, and they're complaining about how health insurance is a major part of this. Yeah. Why is nobody making mention of the fact that if we had socialized health care, then there would be – it would just be one less thing that corporations would have to pay for. Obviously,
it was like 3 years ago. Toyota had cut a deal with Alabama initially. They were shopping states, you know, and Alabama was giving them hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. They ended up at the last minute going to Canada to make their cars. And why? Because the cost of health care in the cars.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me because it seems like the only corporation that would have a problem with this would be the insurance industry, because everybody else would be like, hey, great, one less thing we have to pay for. But yet nobody.
Well, in fact, a lot of corporate leaders have been and continue to be coming out in favor of a national health care program in the United States. So yeah, I think we're moving in that direction. I really believe that we will have some sort of a national health care program in this country within the next 3, 4, 5 years at the most. The larger question in my mind is whether this agenda, this right-wing agenda, this corporatist agenda is going to continue to move along, or whether it's going to collapse, and if it's going to collapse just in the United States or internationally. I think it's going to collapse internationally. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
See, it's being set up as it's conservatives versus liberals. And really what it is it's conservatives versus America. This is the bottom line. And it's happening, by the way, in countries all over the world, that these conservative governing philosophies, largely economic. It always boils down to money, because, you know, at the political level, it all boils down to power, and money is power. That in governments all around the world, now France, the most recent with Sarkozy, you see governments taking a turn to the right and saying, yeah, free trade, it's a wonderful thing. And yeah, let's privatize our schools. And yeah, let's privatize our social security systems. Let's privatize our health care. Let's make it more like that neoconservative paradise, Iraq. That's where they did it. Yeah, flat tax there, 15%. No labor unions. Isn't that cool? Yeah. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Morning, Tom. Yeah, I went to a public school in Michigan. The schools were excellent, even though I grew up in a factory town. I think.
Yeah, me too, in Lansing, Michigan.
Yeah.
In the 1950s and 60s.
But anyway, the point I wanted to make was that Republicans are pretty consistent. They're all about we versus them, or us versus them. And the voucher thing seems to be a dodge. What they'll never actually say is what they're trying to do is they're trying to separate the people, that the kids that they do want to take care of from the ones that they don't.
That is the bottom line, in my opinion. I see this as the balkanization. I was using ghettoization is probably a lousy word. Balkanization is probably a more appropriate word. Less double entendre or whatever. And the balkanization of our schools and one of the main reasons why, by the way, is because most public teachers are unionized. And oh my God, unions! And this is another, you know, in the view of the cons, another way that they can break up the power of unions is breaking up the teachers' unions. Thanks a lot for the call, Tim. And Tim outside Detroit. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. It's Jim, not Tim. That's all right.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make a comment because you're talking lately a lot about the free market solutions and how Republicans, you know, are in favor for it and this and that. But you said a comment a couple weeks ago. A caller called in asking about Ron Paul, and you said some things that completely misrepresented his point of view. And I was wondering if you would ever have him on your show as a guest, so he could.
He's been on this show 3 or 4 times in the last 5 years.
You have.
Yeah, and you can find audio clips of it over at our website.
But you're telling people that, you know, his philosophy is to get rid of public education and, you know, public libraries and things like that.
Right, he's a libertarian. Those were the positions he took when he ran for president.
He's in favor of having states run the publicly funded schools, not the federal
government. If they choose to.
No. He's talking about getting the federal government out of the public schools, like having and implementing things like No Child Left Behind and programs
right.
that don't work.
Right. He doesn't think that the federal government should play any role in education,
yeah,
in libraries, et cetera, et cetera.
People there would be no public schools, and that's not true. There would be. They would be state-controlled public schools. They wouldn't be taken over by Halliburton or some private corporation.
But to extend that, Ron Paul would also submit to you that the federal government should not tell the states that they must have public schools.
Well,
or that they must,
you can
or that they must have integrated public schools.
You can send your child to a private school. You can send your child to. I don't even think you're misrepresenting him. And I was curious if you would have him on your show as a guest so he could explain it.
Sure. Yeah. We're on it. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. David, let's see if we can get Ron Paul on. again. It'd be an interesting conversation. Kevin in Arkansas. Hey, Kevin. Kevin, Arkansas? You're on the air? Apparently not. Okay, David Monroe, Louisiana. Hey, David.
Oh, hello, Tom. I just want to say, you know, there was a time before free trade, and the country did pretty well back then. So I don't
see why. Yeah, 200 years.
Yeah, I don't see why we don't bring that up more often.
Yeah, well, I try to bring it up as often as I can, and well said, David. We had a tariff-based trade system from the founding of this country up until Bill Clinton finally kicked the doors open with NAFTA, GATT, and WTO, and it, as you say, it worked just fine. Thank you very much. Keith, listening on WYKNI or YNK, I don't see a city here, Keith. Where are you?
Baton Rouge.
Ah, okay, great. What's up?
I'm a conservative, but my brethren are wrong with the voucher issue. I'm also a public school teacher who's taught for 15 years. Mm. Let me ask you, is there more crime in East L.A. than Beverly Hills?
Depends on how you define crime.
I would
submit to you, Keith, that there are probably more, in absolute dollars, there is probably more crime in Beverly Hills than there is in East L.A.
I guess violent crime. My point isn't to blame East L.A., but does that mean that the cops in Beverly Hills do a better job keeping violent crime under control than East L.A. does? And the answer is no, because poverty is the driving issue in East L.A. And the same point can be made about our public schools. You cannot compare a public school in a rich, affluent suburb to a poor inner-city school, and I've worked at both. And you could exchange the staff, the building, the books, the teachers, and within the next year you would have the same results, because failing education is a function of a failing community.
Yep, I agree. I agree. And I've done consulting work for public schools in both types of communities, and I absolutely agree with you. And that's why the voucher system is so destructive, because what it does is it basically pits those two communities against each other.
Exactly. And what we really need to face here is the driving cause. There's a book, A Framework for Understanding Poverty, by Dr. Ruby Payne, who actually argues that there are cultural aspects to living in poverty that cross racial lines between blacks, whites, and Hispanics.
Oh, the majority of people in poverty in the United States are white.
Exactly. And whites are likely to drop out just like blacks are, just like Latinos are, if they're poor. And the reason is because poverty is a state of mind as much as it is a state of financial belief, a financial state. And what happens is people do not believe anymore that they can succeed.
Yeah.
So
and good point, Keith, and thus all the more the tragedy. And to a certain extent, in many cases, they can't. Although there is always the exception to the rule. There's always the person who rises up out of poverty. But the fact of the matter is that if Einstein had been born in the ghettos of Bangladesh, we would never have heard of Albert Einstein. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
So back in 2004, as conservative churches across the United States were passing out, courtesy, as I recall, of Jerry Falwell, it might have been Pat Robertson, one of those guys, had published these voters' guides, where the candidates stand on the issues. As churches, conservative churches across the United States, were passing out tens of millions of voters' guides, a church in Pasadena, just a few days before the 2004 election, the All Saints Episcopal Church, had its former regular pastor come in and give a guest speech. He's the retired guy, and he basically gave a sermon on, you know, if there was a debate between George Bush, John Kerry, and Jesus, who would win? And as you may guess, he concluded Jesus would win. And he came out and said explicitly that he was not endorsing or condemning either candidate, and that people of good faith, implicitly in his church, could support or vote for either candidate, that this wasn't an attempt at a partisan diatribe. But he did speak out forcefully in favor of peace, because that's one of the central messages of Jesus' ministry. Well, the IRS ignored all of the conservative churches all across the United States that were passing out these voters' guides and the Justice Sunday guys and all. They completely ignore all that stuff. And now it turns out, apparently with some collusion from the Department of Justice, I'm assuming this was the John Ashcroft period. This was pre-Gonzalez. But Ashcroft was as much of a political hack as Gonzalez. Ashcroft, you'll recall, was the guy who ran against a dead guy in Missouri for the United States Senate and lost. And so, you know, Bush rescued him from political obscurity and made him attorney general. That the attorney general's office apparently was involved with the IRS, and there should be, I mean, these organizations have no logical connection to each other. That the attorney general's office was apparently involved in, we don't know yet how, with the IRS in this thing. Well, the investigation of this church ended, the church having spent $200,000 defending themselves, by the way, ended just apparently yesterday. Or apparently, actually, I guess it must have been the end of last week, because it was on Sunday, in the Sunday sermon that the pastor said, it looks like this is the end of it. The agency, this is from the Los Angeles Times, the agency wrote in its letter to All Saints Episcopal Church that officials still considered the sermon to have been illegal. But they didn't tell him why. Right? We think what you did was illegal. We're not going to prosecute you, though. So the church is now saying, all right, if what we did was illegal, tell us what part of it specifically. If you're going to play thought police, tell us exactly what we said or thought that was wrong, or word police. And by the way, why were you guys investigating us? And what was the connection between this and the Justice Department? Which is a really legitimate question. And I think that there's a larger issue here. I mean, the IRS has just told this church that they're not going to go any further. But as the Reverend Edwin Bacon Jr. said, this has had a chilling effect on freedom of clerics to preach on morality, war, and poverty. Now, apparently, there's been no chilling effect about preaching about gods, gays, or guns. But when it comes to morality, war, and poverty, the traditional Christian issues and Jewish issues, I would add, And Muslim issues, for that matter, and Buddhist and Hindu. Chilling effect. At the same time, yesterday, I shared with you that report from, or was it yesterday, the day before, whatever, I think it was Monday, from KLSA-TV, the TV station in Louisiana, where a whistleblower attended one of these training sessions that the Department of Homeland Security is holding right now for clergy, for ministers, teaching them how to help pacify the population in the event of a national emergency or disaster, or maybe martial law, who knows. On top of this, we find that when George Bush came into office, within weeks of coming into office, he started this program, Faith-Based Initiatives Program. In 2003, they gave out $1.17 billion. In 2004, the election year, they gave out $2 billion. That's $2,000 million to religious organizations through seven federal agencies. Now, even the U.S. Small Business Administration has gotten in, along with nine other agencies. This is as of mid-February. This is from a report from Media Transparency, by the way, .org. Creating its own Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. And there's a website for it. This is the Small Business Administration. So, you know, if you're a religious group, and you can set up shop and say, by the way, we're, you know, fill in the blank. No fill in the blank accepted. No other religions accepted. So we have kind of a national endowment for the religious in the United States now, but the National Endowment for the Arts, how much did they get? Well, last year their budget was $160 million. While the faith-based initiative was $2,000 million. And yet this has never been ratified by Congress. This is something Bush just pulled out of the hat, did it by executive order. And what it reflects is a larger view that, that frankly concerns me tremendously. And should this get to the Supreme Court, that concerns me even more because of Justice Scalia. On November 23rd, 2004, now I realize this is some time back, but this comes right back to this, to what we learned this weekend about this church in Pasadena, the IRS saying, okay, we're not going to prosecute you any further. In November 23rd, 2004, the Associated Press reported that in the synagogue that is the home to America's oldest Jewish congregation, Scalia, Justice Scalia, noted that in Europe, religion-neutral leaders almost never publicly use the word God. Did it turn out that, this is Scalia asking this rhetorical question, did it turn out that by reason of the separation of church and state, the Jews were safer in Europe than they were in the United States of America? And then he answered himself saying, I don't think so. Now, I've got to say, Scalia has an extraordinary way of not letting the facts get in the way of his arguments. He was born in 1936. He should be old enough to remember the photographs that came out of Germany when he was a boy. Like the April 20th celebration declared by Pope Pius II of Hitler's birthday. Yes, the Pope declared a celebration of Hitler's birthday. The belt buckles of the German army, which declared Gott mit uns, God is with us. The pictures of the 1933 investiture of Bishop Ludwig Müller, the official bishop of the Thousand Years of Peace Nazi Reich. Because Hitler did exactly what Scalia is recommending. He merged church and state. See, Scalia is saying, oh, you know, separation of church and state, bad thing in Europe, didn't help the Jews. No, it was the merger of church and state in Germany that led to this. In fact, Hitler created a decree. 14th of July, 1933, it was called the Decree Concerning the Constitution of the German Protestant Church. And Article 1 merged the German Protestant Church into the government and gave the Reich the legal authority to ordain priests. Article 3 of this decree, passed again in 1933, this is right after Hitler took power, provides absolute assurance to the new state church that the Reich will fund it. Even if that requires going to Hitler's cabinet, it says, quote, should the competent agencies of a state church refuse to include assessments of the German Protestant Church in their budget, the appropriate state government will cause the expenditures to be included in the budget upon request of the Reich cabinet. In other words, we're going to pay for these churches if nobody else does. The new state-sponsored German church's constitution opens. This is the constitution of the German church. At a time in which our German people are experiencing a great historical new era through the grace of God, this is the beginning of Nazism, the new German state church federates into a solemn league all denominations that stem from the Reformation and stand equally, legitimately, side by side, and thereby bearest witness to one body and one spirit, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all of us, who is above all and through all and in all. That's from the Constitution of the Reich Church, merging all the Protestant religions. You'll recall Hitler a few years thereafter, went after the Catholics. Which brings us to one of the main reasons almost always overlooked by modern-day commentators, both left and right, about why the founders and framers were so careful to separate church and state. They didn't want religion to be corrupted by government. I'm going to share with you just a few more thoughts about this, what happened with the Quakers in the United States, what Madison thought about this, and then the question. Should we do away with tax-exempt status for churches in the United States, or should we be more aggressively enforcing these laws?
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Speaking of prayer, let's remember that the Puritans, who came to this country in in the early 1600s, where the official story, or the, it's not the official story, the story that many of us learned in school was they were fleeing religious persecution in England. Well, they had taken over the government of England, you know, the whole Cromwell thing, and it didn't work out so well, and the people of England were saying, no thanks, we don't want a theocracy. We'd rather have a king than religious leaders who tell us that we can't dance, we can't listen to music, and et cetera. And so the Puritans came to the New World and immediately passed a law. This was a law in Plymouth Colony. It was passed in 1658 that said no Quaker. See, the Quakers were too liberal for the Puritans, right? They still are. No Quaker rantor, that's other Protestant, or any other such corrupt person shall be a free man in this corporation. That would be the state of Massachusetts. In other words, you can't live here. Puritans banned Quakers from Massachusetts under pain of death. Norman Cousins writes about this in his book, Faith of the Founders, rather, In God We Trust. He says, and when Quakers persisted in returning to Massachusetts in defiance of law and in practicing their religious faith, the Puritans made good the threat of death. Quaker women were burned at the stake. End of quote from Norman Cousins. Quakers were officially banned from Virginia prior to the introduction of the First Amendment to our Constitution. Again, Norman Cousins, he says, Quakers who fled from England were warned against landing on Virginia's shores. In fact, the captains of sailing ships were put on notice that they would be severely fined. Any Quaker who was discovered inside the ship, the state was fined without bail. Through most of the 1700s in Virginia, a citizen could be imprisoned for life for saying there was no God or that the Bible wasn't absolutely perfect, inerrant. Little wonder, says Cousins, that Virginians like Washington, Jefferson, and Madison believed the situation to be intolerable. Even the oppressed Quakers got into the act in the 1700s. They finally found a haven in Pennsylvania, where they infiltrated the government and promptly passed a law that levied harsh fines on any person who didn't show up for church on Sunday or couldn't prove that they were home reading the scriptures on Sunday. Now, all this was flatly rejected by the founders and the framers of the Constitution. James Madison, one of the founders and one of the framers of the Constitution, the father of the Constitution, in a July 10, 1822 letter to Edward Livingston, he said, we are teaching the world the great truth that governments do better without kings and nobles with them. The merit will be doubled by our second lesson that religion flourishes in greater purity without than with the aid of government. In that same 1822 letter, this is the guy who had been president just a decade earlier. He says, I have no doubt that every new example will succeed, as every past one has done, in showing that religion and government will both exist in greater purity the less they are mixed together. Madison even objected to government giving money to churches to care for the poor. It would be the beginning of a dangerous mixture, he believed, dangerous both to government and to churches. So as president, his first official act as president, or his first veto, February 21st, 1811, and he became president in, I believe it was January of 1811. President James Madison vetoed a bill passed by Congress that authorized government payments to a church in Washington, D.C. to help the poor. Not because he didn't want to help the poor. He thought that this should be a function of government. He absolutely was in favor of it. He just didn't want the money being cycled through a church. He said this would establish what he called a legal agency, in other words, a legal precedent that would break down that wall of separation. In fact, here's what he said in his veto message when he sent it to Congress. He said, because this bill vests the said incorporated church and also provides an authority to provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same, it would be a precedent for giving to religious societies. As such, a legal agency, a legal precedent in carrying into effect a public and civil duty. He also opposed, by the way, although he didn't stop it as president, the appointment of chaplains for Congress. He said the appointment, I'm quoting from James Madison, this is in 1820, he said, is the appointment of chaplains to the two houses of Congress consistent with the Constitution, with the pure principles of religious freedom? In the strictness, the answer on both points must be in the negative. He went on to say that if Congress wanted a chaplain, they should pay for it themselves. He said, if religion consists in voluntary acts of individuals, singly or voluntarily associated, it would be proper that public functionaries, as well as their constituents, should discharge their religious duties. Let them, like their constituents, do so at their own expense. How small a contribution from each member of Congress would suffice for this purpose? How just would it be in its principle How noble in its exemplary sacrifice to the genius of the Constitution and the divine right of conscience. Why should the expense of religious worship be allowed for the legislature be paid by the public instead of the members of the executive or judiciary branch of government? On March 18, 1823, wrote to Edward Everett, he said, the settled opinion here in the United States is that religion is essentially distinct from civil government and exempt from its cognizance, that a connection between them is injurious to both. See, Jefferson was always afraid that if the religious folks got in charge of the government, they'd screw things up terribly and turn us into a theocratic state. Madison didn't think that that was possible. He was concerned that if the government started giving money to religion, that it would corrupt religion and the religious folks would start getting political. And Jefferson didn't think that that was possible. They had these very interesting exchanges between the two of them. And now that we find they were both right, the fears of both of them have been realized. So should we pull tax-exempt status from churches?
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, and stranger and stranger stuff going on out there in the world. Like, if you want to have sex in the backseat of your car, there's a way to do it and a way not to, apparently. As Bernard Staglinger, 24 years old, discovered, he parked his car at a disco and went in and met a girl, and they went out and hopped into what he thought was his car to get it on. And Petra Eichinger, 42, walks into the parking lot and sees a couple of people having sex in her car, which just happens to be the same identical model as Bernard's, and calls the police. Not the right way to do it. Yeah, I don't know if you want to call sex a religious thing. That maybe that's where state and religion should meet. It's like protecting the sanctity of a person's car. I don't know. What we have right now is Reverend Moon, who says that, by the way, if you're a good Moonie, if you're going to have sex, you have to have a photograph of Reverend Moon in the room watching you. Reverend Moon, owning the Washington Times, arguably one of the most politically influential newspapers in Washington, D.C., and his Moony front guy, Tony Blankley, out there all over the place. You have Reverend Moon funding activities of both George Herbert Walker and George W. Bush. Reverend Moon bailing out Jerry Falwell back in the day when his Liberty University was tanking. Moon was crowned by several members of Congress in the Senate Dirksen office building on March 23, 2004, as the Washington Post noted in a story on July 21st by Charles Babington. Moon himself proclaimed to our elected representatives who were attending the ceremony, quote, "Emperors, kings, and presidents have declared to all heaven and earth that Reverend Sung Myung Moon is none other than humanity's savior, messiah, returning lord, and true parent," end quote. Now, this is the guy who owns the paper, that writes the editorials that George W. Bush reads, and that issues the marching orders to the Republican Party. I got to tell you, in some distant place, Adolf Hitler and Bishop Mueller, right? Bishop Mueller, you remember the guy? 1933, Hitler sets up the official state church. They've got to be smiling at Scalia's encouragement of the growing conflation of church and state in the United States. It's exactly what they wanted to achieve. It's exactly what they did achieve. And it was one of the things that facilitated the horrors of the Third Reich. So how do we deal with this in the United States? Well, the deal that we made with churches is we said, you can be about being churches. And in fact, we will subsidize you. We will pay for your fire service. We'll pay for your police service. We'll pay for the parking lot, you know, or the streets that'll get people to your parking lot. We'll pay for basically all your infrastructure, public civic infrastructure. We'll pay for the commons. In other words, we'll pay the taxes. We'll pay your taxes. We'll distribute them equally among all the rest of us. You don't have to pay any taxes. In exchange for that, Keep your nose out of politics. Let's go back to this idea that Madison and Jefferson had of a separation between church and state. And now we have, on the one hand, we have the religious getting very involved in politics, James Dobson and company out there, you know, Justice Sundays and whatnot. And on the other hand, we have George W. Bush handing $2 billion a year, $2,000 million a year to religious organizations in the United States. There's just something wrong with this, fundamentally wrong with it. And the only group that gets gone after in all of this is one Episcopalian church in California whose preacher dared suggest before the 2004 election that Jesus was in favor of peace. Something really, really stinks here. And I don't think it's good for America. I don't think it's good for our democracy. And frankly, I don't think it's good for religion. Bob in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Bob.
Hi. I agree. We need to be strengthening the laws that separate church and state. And right now, they're being eroded at an alarming rate. And my objection is that the church is the oldest form of oligarchical, collectivistic totalitarianism the world has ever known.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that. I'd say probably warlord kings. You know, I'm not sure which came first, but you know, they tend to go arm in arm or hand in hand. And you look at the history of a variety of churches, and you see that. On the other hand, there are other churches you don't see. The Baha'i, for example, Buddhism by and large. I don't think any war has ever been fought in the name of Buddha. But your point.
Communism, as we know it in this era, came out of the thinking of the church. It was to be the counter-revolution towards Protestantism.
Right, and communism elevated atheism to basically, in my opinion, to a religion. You know,
totalitarianism is never put forward under its own name, and it had to be a secular phenomena. But could have anyone stopped Stalin if he decided to make the entire Soviet Union a Eastern Orthodox theocracy? Well, the thinking of the church was, once the whole world was an oligarchical collectivism, it would be brought back to the patronage of the church.
Right. Well, and that was Hitler's thought as well. I mean, Reich Bishop Mueller, when he was invested in 1934, I think it was, 33 was when they passed the law, when he, by the way, committed suicide at the end of the war. I mean, he had the good sense or good graces, I guess, to commit suicide. But Reich Bishop Mueller was going to be the guy who was going to rule over the world during the thousand-year reign of peace that was going to be the Third Reich. Bob, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Genia, in Ithaca, New York. Am I pronouncing your name right? Genia? I guess I'm pronouncing it wrong. Genie. Pete in Nassau, New York. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Oh, yeah, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah, let me introduce myself. I'm a 75-year-old Korean War veteran who lives in Nassau County, very well due to an IBEW pension and Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I used to be part-time assessor for a village. One-third of the property in the village where I am now is tax-exempt. So therefore, the other two-thirds are supporting the tax-exempt. The tax-exempt, I would say, is 99% religious.
Yeah. And so, therefore, do you think that we should say to churches, sorry, no more tax exemption, you have to pay, at the very least, property taxes?
Once I remember Jerry Ferraro saying, there's no simple answers to very complex problems. She was arguing with some conservatives that you might say that, but politically it's a hot potato.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Louise and I founded a community for abused kids in New Hampshire in 1978, the New England Salem Children's Village, and I'm still on the board here 27 years, 28 years, however long it's been later. And we voluntarily paid our property taxes for over 20 years because we were in a town of 700 people. And we had 136 acres. and we were at the end of a three-mile-long dirt road, you know, around a lake, and the town had to plow it every day in the winter, and the winters are pretty ferocious in New Hampshire, and we just figured, you know, we've got to be paying back to the town. And now the town has grown, and there's, you know, other businesses and other communities, and it's kind of spread into Plymouth and whatnot, and the tax base has broadened, and so a couple of years ago, we said to the town, we are going to exercise our tax-exempt status. And there's been some blowback, shall we say. But, yeah, it's a tough one. And then,
there's some ideas.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the...
Somebody will call in and help.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a really tough one. And then there's the issue of the income tax, because there are not-for-profit corporations, and they're set up in a different way than for-profit corporations. There are no shareholders. There's no distribution of profits. There's a different set of rules if you want to maintain tax-exempt status, and churches mm-hmm. fall under that. And I think that that's a good thing, but I absolutely support the idea that if a church starts participating in politics, they lose their tax-exempt status, and that government should not be giving money to churches. I mean, I think it just boils
right
down to that.
What do we say to the atheist? He's got to pay taxes to help support them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if one-third is tax-exempt, they're helping picking up the tab.
Hey, in a democracy, there are always going to be things that we disagree with.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I disagree with the war in Iraq, and yet I'm paying my taxes. I can give you a long list of things that the government's doing that I disagree with.
Yeah.
And you know, it's
well, before
just...
you were talking to that gentleman from was running for Senate.
Yeah.
Every time they have to go toe-to-toe with a guy like you, they lose.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Pete. I got to move along. I appreciate the call. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love the show.
Thank you.
The point you just made about tax-exempt status for churches is pretty important. They're not actually required to file an annual tax return, or they call it an information return. But churches aren't. Schools are, public charities are, private foundations are, and you can actually go online and get access to a lot of these tax returns that state who's contributing to them and how much they're paying to their employees and other people who work for them. You can't with all churches, and I think that's a big issue.
This is because in 1913 was when we first came up with tax exempt status for churches and charitable organizations. But it was in 1954 when Lyndon Johnson was the head of the Senate that they passed the legislation saying that under the IRS code, churches who engaged in political activity could lose their tax, or any of these 501c3 organizations could lose their tax-exempt status. And he was doing that in large part because he had a bunch of nonprofit foundations, right-wing foundations, that were crawling up his backside and making him very uncomfortable. It was sort of his attempt at payback. But frankly, I think it's a good thing. I think it's worked out. But, yeah, there actually are websites that tell churches how they don't have to file with the IRS. I'm not sure that that's absolutely the case, but I think that they should have to. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
No surplus, now it's gone. Oh, the debt grows every day. Yes, the balance of our loans is bigger than Star Jones. Tell the kids they'll have to pay. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I wish this debt would go away. Could try to pay these bills, or sell Dick Cheney's pills, or put Congress on eBay. And we owe
so much as a result of 26 years of Reaganomics. Welcome back, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Mike in Newark, New Jersey. Hey, Mike, listening to WWRL. What's on your mind today?
Yeah. Isn't it true, though, if the tax exemption of churches were enforced, it would really hurt Democrats because so many black preachers register voters and engage in political speeches at these churches. I'm thinking of Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, I think the Jesse Jackson is more the exception than the rule. And I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If Jesse, I believe it's Operation Push that Jesse is running that's registering Democrats or the registering voters, actually. They don't ask, are you a Republican or a Democrat? They're just registering voters. But that's where it gets really narrow, because the IRS regulation says that you get nailed if you advocate for the for or against the election of any individual or any specific public policy. I'd have to find the exact language, but it's words to that effect. And registering somebody to vote is not advocacy. And so, you know, arguably, there's nothing wrong with that. That's not a violation of this rule that we have. But, you know, you raise the issue of how, you know, where are the rules? Where are the lines? And frankly, I think that it's worked since 1954. I think it's worked quite well. It just hasn't been enforced. And that's where I would go with it. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Thomas. I just wanted to say that I'm Episcopalian and, you know, basically a card-carrying liberal, too. And you know, the one
they're
thing
not that, incompatible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really is. I mean, if you look quite often, I mean, for people who aren't in the know, you know, if you subscribe to Sojourners Magazine, there's a very good Christian liberal magazine that has progressive causes in it. And I think one of the things for anybody who considers them a Christian is to sort of ask themselves how easy they would be, because really, when you look at the more conservative, whether it be evangelical, Pentecostal, there's a lot of these think that they'll be the one on top. They'll be deciding how to interpret the Gospels. They'll be, you know.
Right, and this goes all the way back to the Puritans. All the way back to the Puritan Revolution in England in what, 1607 or whenever it was.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, the thing is that, I mean, I quite often engage people, and there's quite a bit of disagreement, which there should be in a democracy. But what people don't realize, like, I mean, I've talked to Pentecostal people telling me that it's okay. Even if I don't have the gift of tongues, they can interpret it for me and tell the, you know, and they can tell me what God is saying to me through that. And, you know.
But, you know, I get it, Sean, that you're a religious liberal. But the point of whether churches should maintain tax-exempt status.
I think that definitely, yes, they should be. I mean, I do see that the church is doing a lot of good, basically, that quite often, you know, for all the criticisms that are heaped on churches, quite often even some evangelicals and Protestants are the ones doing a great deal of work out there, whether it be helping the poor or, you know, ministering to the imprisoned.
Right, and I'm all in favor of that, and I think those should be tax-exempt activities. I just, you know, they shouldn't be political activities. Gene in San Francisco, California. Hey, Gene.
Oh, hi. Hi. I agree with you so much, but I'm getting really worried about some of the other things I'm reading about Hillary Clinton and separation of church and state. There was an article in the current Mother Jones magazine called Hillary's Prayer Group, and she belongs to this fundamentalist secret prayer group called the Fellowship. And it's powered by a very secretive guy named Doug Coe, who is called the Stealth Persuader because of all the influence he's had behind the scenes.
Is this the group that runs the house where several members of Congress live?
I don't know about that, but the other members of this group are George Allen and Tom Coburn and Rick Santorum and James Inhofe and Sam Brownback.
Gene, you know, I can't say I share your concern in as much as I don't know all the details of it, but broadly I share your concern, and I think that these are the kind of things that they come into the public arena, and some people are going to say, oh, Hillary's in a prayer group, and isn't that a great thing? And other people are going to say she's in that prayer group, or, you know, or not, and holy cow, you know, but ultimately people have to make up their own minds. But there's a difference between a prayer group and a church, first of all. And secondly, I don't know if this is a nonprofit organization. So, anyhow. Ty in New Mexico? Is that? Ty,
yeah,
I don't have
Tom?
A city for you. I'm sorry.
Tom, can you hear me?
I can. Where are you calling from?
Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Ah, Santa Fe. Okay, great.
Yeah, Tom, I don't always agree with you, but in this case, I do agree with you. And I do feel like the churches should start to have to pay taxes. You know, a couple of points. You know, Jesus needs no help from the government to build his true church, number one. And number two, as long as the church hasn't really fulfilled its mandate to take care of the poor, 90% of what is given to churches goes to, you know, to sustain the church itself instead of, you know, take care of the poor as what Jesus taught. And so I feel because of that, they've abdicated the responsibility to the government.
Well, see,
so
Paul extended that, though. I mean, you know, he and traditionally in most religions, the one of the goals of the church religious institution isn't just to care for the poor; it's to also minister to its own members. It's to be available to its own members. But
well,
you know,
how
in the United States,
do you see that happen?
Well, I think it happens a lot, frankly. I think that's why most people go to church or go to synagogue or go to temple or, you know, as the case may be. Because there is community there. They're finding community. And I think that, you know, back in the beginning, but 1913, you know, we looked at this and we said, okay, there's some functions that we're going to subsidize. We collectively are going to subsidize in a small way by diminishing the taxes, education, good works, you know, caring for the poor and things like that, and religion. And I think it's an appropriate balance. We just need to keep the line drawn.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, another disastrous vote in the Senate. This one 76-22, the Lieberman-Kyle Amendment. As yesterday we were suggesting that you call your senators and say, please vote against this thing. This is what Jim Webb called Cheney's fondest pipe dream. It could be a backdoor method for Congress gaining, or for the administration to say, yeah, Congress is all in favor of our attacking Iran. There were some changes made to it, but it still essentially says that we should combat, contain, and stop Iran via military instruments, or essentially threatens to. And this, instead of a sense of the resolution Senate, which is what it was a couple days ago, this is actually, I believe, an amendment to an appropriations bill. And, you know, you can, over at thinkprogress.org, you can see the list of the senators who voted against it. And God bless them. Biden, Bingaman, Boxer, Brown, Byrd, Cantwell, Dodd. These are the ones who voted no. Feingold, Hagel, the Republican, Hagel, Harkin, Inouye, Kennedy, Kerry, Klobuchar, Leahy, Lincoln, Lugar, McCaskill, Sanders, Tester, Webb, and Wyden. John McCain and Barack Obama did not vote. Interesting. We're going to try something we haven't done, I don't think we've ever done on this program, which is I'm going to essentially moderate a debate. And the reason I'm moderating it, I guess, is because I could probably argue either side of this. We have Matt Prescott with us. He is the manager of the factory farming campaigns for PETA. PETA.org, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And first of all, Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, pleased to have you. Back in I think it was 79 is my recollection, I was running a vegetarian community for abused kids in New Hampshire, and I spoke at a conference. Alex Pacheco, was the leader of PETA at the time. And in fact, I took a lot of flack for the fact that I was wearing a belt that was made of leather on that day. So.
Wait, where in New Hampshire were you?
In Rumney, near Plymouth. But that's not where the speech was. It was down in Washington, D.C.
I'm from New Hampshire, which is why I asked.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it's the organization's still there. And then we also have with us Eric Barron. Eric is with the NorthStarWriters.com or NorthStarWriters.com, the website. He's a freelance writer, columnist, and blogger who specializes in environment and science-related issues. And Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. So here's the question, and you know the topic, the setup. This, can you be an environmentalist and still be a meat eater? And you know, a lot of us who have been vegetarians for a lot of years. One dimension of that is, hey, it's living lightly on the planet. On the other hand, There are people, Eric, you're going to take the position, I'm assuming, that you can still be a meat eater and an environmentalist. Let's let Matt first set the thing up, and then we'll get a rebuttal from Aaron.
Okay. Sure. I mean, you certainly can be, but you undo a whole lot of good by eating meat. It's the number one cause of global warming. The UN found that it actually causes more greenhouse gas emissions than every car, truck, plane, ship, SUV, Hummer, et cetera, on down the line in the world combined.
How can that be?
Well, it's not just the massive amounts of methane and nitrous oxide that are coming out of factory farms, but it's also carbon dioxide. It takes huge resources to funnel plants, to funnel crops through animals to produce meat. You have to run all of the machinery in the farms to produce the crops. You have to run all the vehicles to transport them to the farms and to convert them into feed. You have to run the factory farms and the slaughterhouses and the refrigerated trucks to transport the carcasses to the grocery stores. And so all things put together, the meat industry accounts for about 18% of greenhouse gases, which is about 40% more than the entire transportation system in the world combined. That's, again, all the cars and trucks and SUVs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Eric Barron, how can you be a meat eater and be an environmentalist?
Well, you know, obviously there are several different options, you know, aside from just factory farms. You know, here in Michigan we have a great tradition of hunting, and, in fact, I've got some venison in my freezer, and we're getting ready to start archery season next week. You know, that has nothing to do with livestock raising or the, you know, the factory farms or anything like that. And there are also a lot of people up here in Michigan and probably throughout the country, have hobby farms, which, you know, are essentially closed loop operations where, you know, they take, you know, animal manure and use that as fertilizer and then use that to grow crops that they turn around and feed to the animals and, turn the animals into meat. So, I don't think anybody's going to argue that factory farms are in any way, you know, good for the environment. But, you know, it's a bit much to say that you can't be an environmentalist and eat meat.
But okay, so it seems that both of you are pulling back from an extreme pole on this issue. But the fact of the matter, Eric, is that if we didn't have factory farms in the United States or their small-scale equivalent in a lot of other nations, probably 90% or maybe 60 or 70% anyway of all of the flesh-based foods, the meat, chicken, pork, whatnot, out there in stores and restaurants wouldn't be there.
Sure. And, you know, again, nobody's saying that you shouldn't also cut back on meat. You know, we're talking about, and, you know, particularly, you know, PETA comments that you can't be an environmentalist and eat meat, which was tied to a campaign against, you know, they contacted Al Gore and, you know, this was involved in Al Gore's work on global warming. You know, I mean, the thing is you should cut back on meat, obviously. You know, there's a lot of things that people should be doing to help fight global warming, you know, individually, and cutting back meat is one of them. Taking a look at factory farms, you know, here in Michigan we've had a problem with factory farms all year. In fact, we have one that's getting ready to, you know, probably some serious sewage problems. But, you know, it's really about individual choices and cutting back as opposed to just simply adopting a fairly, you know, extreme look at things, I guess.
So Matt Prescott, I'm sorry, Eric, you were going to... another point.
I think Matt was going to say something.
Okay, yeah, Matt. Here's the question: we have there's a long human history. I mean, a 165,000 year long, fairly clear, you know, fossil and cultural record of a human history of people living in a way that, by and large, in many cases, not always. This is not the total noble savage argument, but by and large, in many cases, has been environmentally appropriate. And you know, about 15% of their diet typically is meat. And so, you know, how do you counter that?
Well, with today's population and with the demand for meat at what it is, there's no sustainable way to do it. Even if you're running a hobby farm and you only have a few chickens or a few cows or pigs or what have you, you're still engaging in behavior that is not environmentally sound, because in order to produce 1 pound of flesh from an animal, it requires about 16 pounds of grain. So no matter whether you run a factory farm or a hobby farm,
not if the animal's grazing. If you've got a large enough field and they're just eating grass, you know.
16 pounds of grass then in that case of plant matter to produce 1 pound of flesh. So again, right. Whether it's a factory farm or a hobby farm, if you're taking multiple pounds of plant matter, funneling it through an animal, and then producing 1 pound of meat, of food to some people, then that's unsustainable. There are better ways to do it.
Let me
challenge Eric or anybody else who says, well, I get, you know, my meat from a hobby farm or I hunt it. Do you really get all of the meat you eat from a hobby farm? Because we find that when people say that, they mean, well, maybe some of it comes from a hobby farm. Maybe some of the meat in their freezer was purchased from down the street. But
yeah, well, I think the kind of moral issue has been defined, and there seems to be some consensus between the two of you. We only have a minute left. Let me just toss something out. What if we were to go to a carbon tax or stop subsidizing water for agriculture, and the cost of meat were actually to rise to reflect its true cost on the environment? Eric Barron, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, I have no problem with making sure that people have to pay the price for you know, their activities. I, you know, question whether that kind of thing would be, you know, politically tenable, personally. But I have no personal problem, with it.
Yeah. Matt, your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are that with so many great vegetarian options out there, vegan barbecue ribs and veggie dogs, veggie hot dogs, veggie chicken nuggets, and so on available at
a lot of those are heavily processed too, though.
Restaurants,
I mean,
that you know, there's just never an excuse to eat meat. There's no need to. And anybody who wants to actually learn more, and I wrote a lot of this myself, coming from an environmental background, can go to our website. It's goveg.com, where there's all kinds of information about how meat is horrible for the environment.
Okay, Matt Prescott, goveg.com. Eric Barron over at NorthStarWriters.com. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Interesting conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be taking your calls on pretty much anything you want to talk about today. What's on your mind? And I'll get some more details to you about this Lieberman-Kyle amendment. This is really grim right after this.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
So, America, here's how your senators voted. This on the Kyle Lieberman amendment. Among those, at least those who were running for president of the United States. And this is what I don't get is why this thing even had to be there for a vote. It just seems to me that this is another, you know, Karl Rove, or maybe it's a let's get us in position for a war with Iran. But why was this even there in the first place? 76-22, this passed. Senator Dodd, running for president, voted against it. Senator Obama, running for president, did not vote. Senator McCain, running for president, did not vote. Let's see here. Senator Clinton, running for president, voted in favor of it. It's very interesting to look at this vote list. It's the 22 nays. Joe Biden, running for president, voted against it. Chuck Hagel and Dick Lugar look like they're Richard Lugar are the only two Republicans who voted against it. Bernie Sanders, of course, voted against it. And then you've got a bunch of Democrats who voted against it. But this piece of legislation, this amendment, they added a paragraph at the end that says Secretary of Defense Robert Gates stated on September 16, 2007, that I think that the administration believes at this point that continuing to try and deal with the Iranian threat The Iranian challenge through diplomatic and economic means is by the preferable approach. That the one we are using. We always say all options are on the table, but clearly the diplomatic and economic approach is the one that we are pursuing. End of quote. That paragraph was added. And a couple of paragraphs were taken out, which apparently were paragraphs that paragraphs 3 and 4, one that said that it should be the policy of the United States to combat, contain, and stop the violent activities and destabilizing influence inside Iraq. This was taken out. And another, number 4, to support the prudent and calibrated use of all instruments of the United States national power in Iraq, including diplomatic and economic intelligence and military instruments. So the two paragraphs that basically made this an authorization for war have been removed, and maybe that's why you had a bunch of Democrats who were willing to go along with it. It's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out as time goes on, how people are justifying their vote, what they have to say about it. But, you know, I'm interested in why this thing came to a vote in the first place. And, you know, can you be an environmentalist and vegetarian at the same time? This all started, by the way, with PETA calling out Al Gore and saying, okay, you're running around the world talking about global warming, quit eating meat. So, a lot on the table, many different topics that we've talked about today. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Mike in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, regarding this vegetarian versus meat eating, I mean, I think, you know, our environment should describe to us what we should be eating. I mean, if you're living in, you know, if you're a Eskimo living up in, you know, Inuit region or something, I don't think, you know, guacamole and being a vegetarian is probably the proper diet up there.
Right, it's not an option.
It's not an option, exactly.
On the other hand, there are people around the equatorial belt all around the world who live very heavily on plant-based foods, on plant-based diets. I think Frances Moore LePay in her book Diet for a Small Planet was the first to point out that
right.
rice and beans is a perfect mixture of essential amino acids to produce complete proteins.
I think our bigger environmental problem is the food industry. I mean, here where I live in Santa Fe, I mean, it's the amount of food, the population we have here, and the amount of food we eat, you know, everything from kiwi fruit to whatever, I mean, none of it grows here. And it's the transportation. How many miles of transportation, to, you know, energy units, that's what
there's a huge movement going on here in Portland, Oregon, and I'm assuming that's going on, you know, in communities all over the country, to buy locally. And, you know, a lot of farmers markets, Louise and I do a lot of our shopping at local farmers markets. Even the local, kind of local variation of the local chain store version of Walmart, it's called Fred Meyer's. They have a large grocery store. They have become now the largest purchaser of organic food from the local organic co-op of local farmers. It's really, you know, and God bless them for it. They also pay decent wages, by the way.
All food should be labeled with mileage on it.
Yeah, there you go. And or taxed based on the mileage, because, you know, the fact of the matter is that we as a country are paying about $10 a gallon for gasoline. About, you know, $3 of that is paid at the pump. About $4 of that is paid in our health care bills for all the cancers and emphysema and other diseases caused by the pollution. And about $3 to $4 of that is paid for by the impact of global warming on all of us. And so, you know, if we can't directly include that tax by, you know, at the pump, then perhaps we should added into things transported from out of state. Not just food, I would say. In fact, you know, if somebody's going to buy furniture made out of state, or if they're going to buy clothing made out of state, we should be considering the possibility of a transport tax, which goes back to the suggestion that I made during the debate between these two guys of maybe a carbon tax, because that's one way to do it. It's discussed actually at some length in Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, The 11th Hour. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back, my friends. Just a reminder, I'll be back. I'll be speaking at the Green Festival October 6th in Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. Convention Center at 6 p.m. on the main stage. So drop by, check it out. Bring a book if you want it signed, and say hi. Look forward to seeing you if you're in the Washington, D.C. area. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, TomHartmann.com. If you want to get into our live chat room and drop in and say hi, I hang out there during the break. And, in fact, Sue reminded me during the break that in my $10 per gallon calculation for the cost of a gallon of gasoline, I had forgot to include the cost of the military that is protecting our oil supplies all over the world. And given that the cost of the war in Iraq is now probably going to push $2 trillion when all is said and done, probably gasoline is costing us $20 or $30 a gallon right now in real terms. I mean, we're massively subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, massively subsidizing it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see, John in Mill Valley, California. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just thought I'd bring up a point about the you're not an environmentalist if you eat meat. For decades, I've worked in the restaurant industry here in Northern California, and I'm writing down right now close to a dozen different companies that locally produce organic meats and have been for decades around the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and Central California. And
Yeah, but Matt's point is that they could never supply all the demands of that metro area. I mean, if you were to say, okay, we're going to pass a law tomorrow that everybody in the San Francisco Bay Area or Mill Valley or wherever it is has to buy only organic and locally grown beef or meat products, meat, chicken, pork, there wouldn't be enough, or everybody would have, you know, one serving a week.
Well, I suppose that would be true for the short run, you know, like anything. But it's like you said earlier, the quote you gave earlier, there's no simple solution to complicated problems. And I think that it's oversimplifying it. I think it's simpler to focus on not eating processed foods and not eating foods with certain ingredients that are chemicals but are described as foods like corn syrup, you know. Other preservatives and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point, John. And also, not eating.
There's a lady, Marion Nestle, who talks about it a lot in her books. She's an author. She's really educated on food and food science and so on. And she's got a dozen books on all these situations.
Okay.
So I just want to make that point.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You made it well. And also not eating things from far, far away. And that's, you know, it's just it's a good idea. Warren in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Warren.
Hey, Tom. Say, I want to run a question by you. I'm wondering if it would be of any use for we who are trying to figure out what to do to help with our U.S. problem here. Could we enlist...
Which problem are you talking about, the Kyle Amendment?
Well, the potential to go to Iran, actually.
Yeah, war with Iran,
What I'm wondering is if we can enlist the international community through the UN to help prevent that. If it's worth a roll of stamps or something that's going to do a half an ounce of good, I'd be glad to do it. But I don't know.
The problem is that the official voice of the United States in the United Nations is the U.S. ambassador to Iran, to the United Nations. It's not you or me. And the United Nations is not a group that you can lobby. You can only lobby the member nations. So really what we need to do is we need to change our president, who is the person who appoints the ambassador to the United Nations. And I'm of the opinion that we should change our president and vice president by the route of impeachment. I consider that extremely unlikely. And so what we're going to have to do is wait another, let's see, what do we have here? 481 days, 10 hours, 15 minutes, and 24 seconds until George Bush is, you know, leaves office voluntarily, assuming that there's no crisis that causes him not to between now and then, God forbid, and, you know, leaves office voluntarily and we have another president. And I think that's going to happen. But unfortunately, we can't lobby the UN. Michael in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Michael.
Hi. I had to chuckle at the Republicans' objections to the $35 billion health care proposal for children. They object.
Yeah.
They call it it's letting government run health care, as if these kids don't belong to this country that they govern. You know, the reason that government-run health care is the price that you have to pay when you let lobbyists run government to the expense, to the enrich themselves and at the expense of others. This is, it's no surprise. This is what you're going to get. Of course it's government health. We're going to have government-run health care until you get the lobbyists out of Washington using their positions as open-ended architectures to create their own markets.
Right, which brings us back to the solution that Bernie Sanders has been talking about on this program for 4 years, that many of us have been pushing for decades, which is that we need to have federal funding of elections. We need to simply say that's it. You know, if you're going to run for political office, we collectively, we the people, will pay the bill for our elections. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, the last election cycle, for example, there was about $1 billion spent. I mean, it's an enormous amount of money because the 2000 election cycle was about $500 million. You go back, you know, just 15, 20 years, you know, back before Reagan, and it was much, much smaller than that. But now it's say $1 billion. Okay. There's 115 million working adults in the United States, more or less. So $1 billion from 115 million people, if I'm doing my math right, would be about $9 a person. And because that's every other year, or every fourth year, actually $1 billion, probably in the off year elections, it's about $500 million. It would end up being around $5 a person. That little box that you check when you file your taxes, you know, it's only $2 or $3 now, I think, maybe $4, I'm not sure. But, you know, whatever it is, it's if everybody did that, we could fully fund all of our elections. We just say that's it. That's it. Nobody else can participate. And, I see that as the solution. It's something that is working well in Arizona. It's working well in Maine. It's working well here in Portland, Oregon. A lot of communities around the country are doing it. Scott in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Yeah, and hey, Tom, how are you doing this afternoon?
Just fine, but I will get better.
Yeah, you will get better, always. I was calling about your last guest about, I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous, about the functionality of hobby farms and the sustainability of raising cattle and eating livestock. There are ways, and Michael Pollan wrote a book. I'm not going to pimp it because I know you don't like that.
Well, that's okay. You can mention his book.
It's called The Omnivore's Dilemma, and he covers the whole gamut of our whole eating cycle. And a lot of the organic farms really use a lot more petroleum than we really think.
Mm-hmm.
And he does cover one farm called Polyphase Farm, where the gentleman that runs the farm has actually improved the quality of his land through raising cattle, and then he runs chickens through his land, and he runs...
Yeah, I mean, in nature, there is a cycle that involves animals and plants. In nature is a closed loop. Everything's waste is something else's food, and by and large, the waste from animals is the food for plants. And so, you know, that would argue for at least some component of a rational agricultural economy, having some component of animals to it, I suppose. Scott, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Jeff in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, I'm an organic farmer. We grow nothing but vegetables. And it's just the last guy you're talking to. We use very little petrochemical.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your guy is right that eventually we're going to have to face up to this meat thing.
Fertilize? I mean, don't you need to use...
I have a couple horses, but three horses is enough to run. They make enough fertilizer for, you know. The other problem with mixing the two is, a lot of the horses seem to be pretty... I don't think there's anything humans and horses get. The cattle and these E. coli breakouts, of course, I think it has more to do with the food handlers. I don't think there's anybody in the food industry really has decent health care until you get to some kind of a manager. So everybody handles your food up until you pick it up at the grocery store. Chances are it doesn't have, you know, has not seen a doctor in years.
Yeah,
but,
which is a whole other issue, but
expensive. Well, yeah, that's what we put in our mouth, though. That's what everybody don't get to, you know. I see what my neighbors spray this for their dairy farms, and every Roundup and all this crap, it's in the groundwater.
And it gets into the food. So it's not just wash it off.
It's worse than the food. It gets into the Chesapeake Bay. It gets into the water table. I mean, it, you know.
Yeah.
But we're going to have to really work on meat. I don't know if we can consume Same with fish. What are we going to do? Scrape the bottom of the ocean for the last?
Yeah, 90% of all the big fish in the oceans, in the world's oceans, are gone.
Right.
I mean, 90%
of all the big fish. Now they're scraping it for the small fish so they can feed the salmon. I mean, it's...
Yeah. No, it's nuts. Yeah, good point, Jeff, and thank you very much for the call, and good on you for being an organic farmer. Bill in Seattle, we have about a half a minute here before we got to take a break, Bill.
Tom, I just wanted to ask you, my understanding was that all humans need to eat some animal protein because it's the only place that they can get vitamin B12, which regulates the neural networks. And
it's not true, Bill. Vitamin B12 is produced in the gut by intestinal flora. And if in a healthy gut, and there are entire cultures. I mean, you look at the Buddhist cultures of Asia that have been vegetarian for generations, for hundreds of years, and maybe thousands of years, without detriment. So, I don't buy it that everybody has to eat meat. On the other hand, I'm not somebody running around saying everybody must become a vegetarian. It's just at a certain point, it's just like with oil, you know. Are you going to drive? Are you going to use a bicycle? More public transportation, less? At a certain point, we have to start looking at these things and saying, you know, what's viable for us going forward as a human race? 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
No business like oil business. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The monks in Burma under attack. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Victoria, two things at the top of my list that I wanted to talk with you about are what's going on in Burma and what's going on with the Kyle Amendment. Before we get to that, is there anything that you see as, first of all, welcome to the show. Victoria? Ah. Hang on just a minute. Let me push the button here. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Now I can hear you.
I'm here. I'm right here.
Yeah, great. Anything that you want to start with before we get to these two topics that are high on my list?
I've got Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and I've got Larry Craig indicating that he's not going to be resigning anytime soon.
Oh, interesting. Okay. He went to court today, didn't he, or his lawyers did?
His lawyers went to court today. They've got arguments this afternoon, and he's basically indicating that he will not be resigning until the judge rules, which is not going to be for a couple more weeks, so he's going to be hanging on. He's looking for a way to stay.
Yeah, the Republican leadership has to just be totally in a knot about this.
Spitting nails. They don't know what to do with him.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay, so, and then you said Robert Gates. There's something going on with Mr. Gates.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates is going to be asking for $190 billion in war funding. We thought he was going to be asking for $141 billion, but oops, gosh, numbers a little bit different. Turns out he wants $190 instead.
And a couple of weeks ago, it was $50 billion.
Yeah, well.
And this is from the administration that says that, $38 billion to fund children's health programs is way too much. $22 billion in a variety of kind of do-gooder things that are various appropriations. Too much.
Well, it's a question of priorities, Tom.
Yeah. Got to have those wars. Got to have those tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires.
That's right. You've got to have the things that people care about, and this is what those people care about. And so that's the things we're going to have.
Okay. So first of all, let's get to the Kyle Amendment here. This Senator Kyle and Senator Lieberman. Offered this amendment to, I believe it's a defense appropriations bill, isn't it?
It is a defense appropriations bill. It's a sense of the Senate thing, And they have changed the language somewhat because the language was getting to be so scary for really quite a lot of people. Nevertheless, there was enough concern about this, and I think that Senator Jim Webb really summed it up for a lot of people when he started to rant basically yesterday in the Senate about it, that to such an extent that Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, basically said, you know something, we're not going to vote on this anytime soon. And so they haven't voted. We're not bringing this.
What I'm showing is that they just voted on it and that Harry Reid voted yes.
Oh, then you're ahead of me because last I'd heard was that they weren't going to vote on it.
Yeah, no, this is a Senate roll call vote, 110th Congress, first session on the amendment. Number 3017 is modified, the Kyle Amendment. And the vote was 76 to 22, and Harry Reid voted yes on it. Reid from Nevada and both Reids, and Reid from Rhode Island both voted yes. And the noes, there were 22 noes. Obama did not vote. Hillary Clinton voted yes. Senator Dodd voted no. Senator Biden voted no. So,
oh, wow. Well, ignore all my reporting henceforth, then, because...
Okay, this just popped up. I mean, it just popped up. Let me talk about Burma for a minute, because we just have a couple of minutes left here. Laura Bush yesterday said something that I thought was actually... I agree with. She said, I pray for the people of Burma. I'm awed by their courage. Here we have this uprising. The many news agencies are now referring to, as is the U.S. government, referring to this country as Burma because the parliament that was democratically elected in 1990 but then never convened because of the military uprising and the military junta that's been running the country since then took over. That parliament refers to the country as Burma. The democratic opposition in the country continues to use the name Burma, but the military junta calls it Myanmar.
I'm pretty sure the BBC calls it Burma, too.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that, but on the other hand, TASS, the Russian news agency, is referring to it as Myanmar.
Well, that's
So it's like, Pravda or whatever. So it's like lines are being drawn in the sand. I know that the U.S. and Great Britain have both said before the United Nations today that sanctions should be increased against this country for cracking down on its own people. I see this, frankly, as a big deal. I mean, this is we're in the midst of the fifth or sixth year of a war that was supposed to stop a dictator, and here we have. I mean, it's playing out right in front of us. Repression on a mind-boggling scale. To what extent is this, or has this become, an issue in the United States Congress?
This is starting to become an issue in the United States Congress. People are starting to realize that this is a major human rights issue. They've long realized that they have a Nobel laureate who is confined to house arrest and that is a big deal. But when you start seeing crimson-clad monks in the streets, and then when you start to see the junta crack down on them, then it starts to become serious. And I think Congress is realizing that and is going to get fully behind the administration on this one.
Yeah, George Bush calling for sanctions.
Issue.
This is going to be an interesting one to see how it plays out because Buddhist monks tend to be pretty fierce. I mean, I remember during the Vietnam War, toward the end of the war, the Buddhist monks, actually even early on, the Buddhist monks pouring gasoline on themselves, and just immolating themselves. They stand on principle, much like Gandhi did.
But they don't mess around.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out. Victoria, great talking with you.
Thanks
so much. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be disagreeing with conservative David Harsanyi on his new book, Nanny State. This is one of the favorite conservative frames, how food fascists, teetotaling do-gooders, priggish moralists, and boneheaded bureaucrats are turning America into a nation of children right. Also, the Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping is going to be here. What would Jesus buy? Chrissy Harvey will drop by. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.